final plenary speaker for our symposium has a most challenging assignment. He is to ply the trades of both synthesizer and soothsayer. That is to bring together various strands of thought which appeared in some of the earlier symposium plenary presentations, as well as conversations that he may have been overhearing during the symposium. And he is also challenged with the assignment of projecting where we go from here, in a sense, in the church's thinking about the theology and practice of worship. I personally know of no other individual who can serve us in Fort Wayne, the Master of Divinity degree from this institution, and the MA and PhD degrees from the University of Minnesota. He was a Fulbright Scholar at the Free University of Berlin in 1969-70, and has done graduate study at the University of Chicago as well. Vic Gebauer's publications have been wide-ranging in terms of subject matter. He has written articles and chapters for books and reviews in the fields of church music, worship, and theology. And even more wide-ranging has been the audience for his scholarly work. He has served a wide constituency with his material appearing in Lutheran circles, Roman Catholic periodicals, and non-denominational journals. He presently serves as editor of Grace Notes, the official newsletter of the Association of Lutheran Church Musicians. I know him to be a scholar, a thinker of great breadth, and one who will certainly keep us alive and awake at this time in the afternoon. It is my distinct privilege to introduce my former colleague, Dr. Victor Gebauer. You're really ready for another one of these sessions, right?
Oh, okay.
When John Johnson asked me to come and do this, was the most unique invitation I've ever had, wrapping a session up like this. And then he said, but you do have to attend all the sessions. Well, at that point, I figured I understood the joke that many of you heard if you studied with Norman Hobble here a number of years ago. I felt like the preacher who felt that with a gift of the Spirit, he really didn't have to prepare his sermons. His congregation got a little tired of this after a while, so they called him into session and said, hey, you know, let's do a little work on these things and so forth. He said, I don't need to. I can preach on any text, any topic, any time. No prep. And they said, come on. He said, you're on, any time. He said, all right, next Sunday. So the next Sunday, he stepped into the pulpit, and there on the desk was an envelope. He opened the envelope, and then there was a slip of paper, and on it was one word, constipation. He stepped back for a second, reflected, turned to the congregation and said, the text for today is, Moses took the two tablets and went out into the wilderness. Here I am in the wilderness. What I'd like to do, as requested, is to articulate, first of all, some of my observations, and very briefly, about where we are if we have to discover Quo Vadimus into the 1990s and beyond, and then maybe just a couple pointers about some resources or observations that might help expand the themes and some of the discussions that I've heard at this conference. I do hope, we're eating into that already with a late start, so I hope you'll forgive me, but I do hope to offer some time for response, which in the rather broad program that was offered to us here this time was a little shorter than some of you would have liked. But I'd like the chance to respond to, or at least offer, the opportunity for as many questions as possible. As we begin this, I'd like to suggest, however, that the fundamental significance of what we've done here today is that worship is the topic of the first symposium, and we, I think, already expressed our thanks to John Johnson and his vision, and to the warm strength of the seminary faculty
in developing this first theological symposium. I hope they go on like this. And the fact that worship is the topic is the clue to where we're going in the 1990s and beyond. If you look back just a second, you realize that in the 1970s, particularly with all attention focused on the work of the Inter-Lutheran Commission on Worship, not only in Lutheranism, but beyond Lutheranism, that was the age of all the new books, the new service books that were published or in preparation at that time. There was a feeling that the church was focused on worship renewal. The 1980s, in turn, became the decade of evangelism and church growth. It was almost the buzzword. And that whole thing leaped into our consciousness, crashed into our consciousness in the case of the Lutheran Church in some cases. Now, if you look back at that scenario, you realize that the 1990s then must be the place where these two aspects of the church's life realized that they are not competitors but spouses, quarreling spouses, however. And I would suggest that where we're going in the 1990s is to take what we have discovered in the 70s and the 80s and realize that it's time to kiss up and to kiss and make up between these two quarreling spouses before everyone else moves out of the house. These two need each other. And oral conversations to the contrary, I think that's been demonstrated at this symposium. And we should have known this all along. Every time we either read in 1 Corinthians or discovered in the liturgy, that as often as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we do proclaim. That's the language of evangelism joined to the language of worship. Or in the Nunc Dimittis, that it is that light which is now shown before all the nations. Or in Matthew 28:19, that we go forth to disciple all the nations by catechesis and by baptism. There is an inevitable linking of evangelism and worship. But as in all spouses, you know, when you've been in the same household for a long, long time, it gets a little sometimes harder to discover what the other person is really thinking and talking. At least that's what I heard from one of my former mentors here. He used to be on the faculty, Bob Bertram, who in the course of church politics of the last two decades was most recently at LSTC in Chicago. I heard him report to the Liturgical Institute at Valparaiso not too long ago. And in his years of retirement, he said he's discovered what most people in his generation do, and that is that it gets harder and harder to understand your spouse, largely because they're mumbling all the time. And he was certain that there was something like that going on, and that his own wife's hearing was a little bit, shall we say, slipping. So he decided to make a semi-scientific test of this. So he reported that he stood at the top of the steps, and he called out to her. I forget her name now. Charlotte, can you hear me? And there was no reply. So he moved down to the bottom of the steps, and he repeated the same thing. He said, Charlotte, can you hear me? And he still didn't get the message. So he walked into the kitchen where she was, stood in the doorway, and said in a very firm, clear voice, Charlotte, can you hear me? And he said, at that point, she wheeled around on him and said, well, yes, and that's the third time I've told you. And I ask myself, is this a parable of the way these two age-old partners in the church, evangelism and worship, are now trying to communicate? It's time to quit quarreling and to nurture the flock. It's time to overcome the fact that I think we have mistakenly departmentalized worship and mission into two separate synodical agencies, different areas of study in the curricula in which we have. Different areas of discussion in terms of our theological enterprise. It's time to get over that and to begin to work together because the two are inevitable without each other. And because of that, I've had a conversion experience at this symposium. Some of you may regard that as someone's revivalistic, that I could be converted within less than 24 hours, but I have to credit this to Steve Huey. In fact, it's been only about 4 or 5 hours, actually. But Huey pointed out this morning that we had this old model, and it's exactly the one I've used in class, where he had a circle. I used to use squares, whereby we have all these separate things going on in the congregation. We have programs. We have education. We have social ministry. And we have this, that, and the other thing, and worship, and evangelism, or mission, or whatever we call that. And they all compete for the budgets. And they all compete also at the synodical level for budgets. And he said, there's a new paradigm. And by golly, it was a circle, and mission was right in the middle. Now, I recognized this paradigm immediately because I had a new paradigm too, only it was worship that was right in the middle. And I thought, well, we haven't gotten past that one. I realized we needed a completely new model. So I think I'm expressing what Healy and a few other people are after, and I'll have to turn here to the screen and the overhead, which they promised they would leave me here from this morning. But with your visionary qualities, we'll call this a blackboard, and I have my marker here for you. Now, in this model, rather than squares or circles or anything else like that, I think we have to recognize that there are two aspects to the same work of the church, mission and worship. I almost called them Janus-headed phenomena, but I realized that you'd regard this only as an updating of New Baalism, so I... But anyway, on this blackboard... Oh, it's over here, excuse me. On this blackboard, could we maybe discover, at least image this a little bit for ourselves, if we draw a baseline, which is the presence of God being proclaimed in this world, proclaimed and celebrated, and in wave form, above and beyond that line, we find a wave motion. On one side of the line, we have worship. On the other side of the line, we have mission, witness. The life of the church and of its people is lived out in the energy that moves us back and forth around that axis. And that creates the song of the church. It is the vibration, the waveform that encompasses both the worship of God and the mission that is central to our life. And we cannot define either one of them adequately without the other. And that's at least basic. I think the great thing that I've heard here is that for all the discussions and even some of the quarrels that have taken place, that there is that kind of searching. It's very strong. And I think that's the first thing I'd like to offer at this point, is to say that where we're going in the 1990s and beyond is at this stage of the journey. What we heard from both sides of this discussion is a very strong commitment to word and sacrament, to justification by faith. We heard this expressed in strong pastoral accents, both from those identified with liturgics and those identified with outreach. Our just, Pastor Thompson, Dean Hempelman, have all articulated their points clearly and pastorally. They are gifts to the church. We cannot compete with any one of them for attention because we need the accents of each. But it's not always clear in practice that this commitment to word and sacrament is shaping our experience in the church. We've seen in the last two or three decades, for example, an increase in the frequency of celebrations of the Lord's Supper. But we've also seen in recent years an increasing unease with exactly that phenomenon in large events in the church, so that there is more and more question about how and why we do this. There's an evangelism implication in that. If we are uncomfortable with the way in which we celebrate the presence of that God whom we are proclaiming in this world, then it becomes more and more difficult for us to witness clearly to who we are. Who we are is nowhere more clear to the world than when we are gathered into the presence of God as he offers himself in word and sacrament. We also have discovered perhaps that we need some further conversation as we use the terms word and sacrament or adiaphoron or anything like that. Because word and sacrament sometimes become mere ciphers which mean more than that. Sometimes when we have discussed these things, we have said, well, it falls into the context of the competition between liturgy and evangelism. And where the primary statement is not only unobjectionable, but fundamental to our teaching, we have tied the significance of that statement, i.e. commitment to word and sacrament, to what we believe are the corollaries if this were carried out to its ultimate implications by the liturgists or by the evangelists. And we have given then the primary statement the same weight as the secondary statement. If you're going to say this, then you must mean invitational worship, and that we can't abide. and then we begin to suspect the primary statements that each of us are making in good faith. And I suggest that that may be a place where we need to stop the quarreling and begin to listen to each other. And again, I'd like to affirm that I heard fine conversations and examples of that here, and for that I offer again thanks to the seminary. Where are we going in the 1990s? I think we're going to the place where word and sacrament become the eschatological realities that were presented to us in our theology here in these last 2 days. We're going to discover in ourselves in a presence that reveals the new and gracious thing that God is doing among us now. We're going to use forms and discover that we do not have to fear form. We're going to understand worship in such a way that that eschatological reality is celebrated because we're doing worship with that sense of proclamation, not only to the visitor, but worship in such a sense that that eschatological reality reaches out and establishes a surprise for those who are gathered into that assembly each time. Good worship ought to do that. It ought to show us something new about ourselves because it is that new thing which God is working in us. That kind of worship will witness. It will not be boring. If, for example, we understand what it means to sing glory to God in the highest and peace to his people on earth, and have joined the angelic song at that point. If we hear hovering over us Isaiah's angels as we sing holy, 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 or as some of you have pointed out, that the ultimate vision of evangelism is that crowd of worshipers around the throne that we discover in Revelation. And then a congregation knows that about itself, that it becomes clear, for example, to the man that my wife talked with some time ago as she was participating in a stewardship campaign in her congregation, a man who did not know whether it was really right for him to give much money to the church. And he had never told anybody this until my wife visited him. The reason was that he beat his wife unmercifully all their married life. And he had taught his adolescent son to do the same thing, so that the two of them were now victimizing this woman, and they hated themselves for it and didn't know how to stop. Worship must reach out and be so clearly identified as the communion of saints that the baptismal forgiveness that is offered to that man and to his wife, and the reconciliation that comes when we turn to each other and offer the peace of the Lord, is a living reality at that point. And at that moment, the visitor will wish he or she were more deeply inside that community. Liturgy that witnesses and is true to itself will reach out to the Christian family, the Cambodian family, which my congregation sponsored, and which could not, that family which could not find housing in the city of St. Paul, even though it was promised, because as the landlord saw this Asian family walking up the sidewalks, suddenly the empty apartments were all filled, until the chairman of our Board of Social Ministry threatened to call the authorities on it. They finally found an apartment. And on Good Friday, of all times, one of the most solemn liturgical moments in Christianity, the adolescent boy of that family was beaten senseless by baseball bats by a crowd of black people who didn't want another race in that area because they themselves knew what it meant to be victimized by other races. And that family has to be enfolded in a community that senses the presence of God so deeply that love can be extended where no love is shown elsewhere. That's one observation of where we are going. Liturgy must move in that direction. And there could be no more powerful support for mission than into doing liturgy that way. The second thing I think we need to deal with as we move into the 1990s, the political uses of worship. One of the things that I think that is a problem for us is that worship is always quite rightly in the thick of things in the church's life. And he only remind you that the common service itself, as it was developed in the 19th century, was clearly a part of the struggle to discover what a confessional identity would mean for the Lutheran Church here in North America. We have our own experience of how worship develops in the midst of political turmoil as we try to work our way toward new service books in the 1970s as the ILCW is completing its work. And now we find ourselves, because of that, a church of three books, not two, as I heard here, incidentally. I did a survey some time ago, or one of my class members did, of congregations in the Twin Cities, and it turns out that in the Twin City area, 20% of the congregations use LBW, and the others are about equally split between TLH and LW. Now, the significance of that is that we can't identify the worship of the church with a book, a point which has been made on confessional basis here earlier in this symposium. That the worship of the church has to be moved back to its primary focus, and that is the presence of God in Jesus Christ. Worship was a focus of turmoil also in the Reformation. Louis Lochner, as he published in the late 19th century, said the same thing, that he felt there was turmoil in the church, and he feared for what might happen. The illusion, then, is that somehow if we would, that there is a possibility that we can settle all this turmoil and discover the right practice, which will go beyond that. It's not going to happen. But in the process of discovering worship, where it belongs in the thick of the church's life, we have to be careful that that we understand worship as the way in which we overcome our politicization and not worship as the means for implementing it. And I was going to say something more about that, but I won't. I think you can draw the implications for that. But I would like to, again, drop this down again to the very real level of what happens in the parish. That has to be modeled in congregational life. When I teach worship planning course, for example, you work with a student. I'll give you one example, who takes the texts, which is where we begin. And I always say, now, you have to put them into the context of some real congregation or some reality in the church's life here today. And if you happen to come from International Falls and you're trying to plan worship for that congregation in a situation where Boise Cascade is trying to build a new plant and has severe labor problems so that scab workers are hired and brought up from Alabama into northern Minnesota and are put up in camps, some of you know about this, and it becomes very violent. And then the local people bring in their union helpers from northern Michigan and tear up not only the projects but some of the camps, and then you have people from both sides walking into church on Sunday morning. You must plan worship in that context. We must not avoid that. And I think we need to model that in the life of the church at large as well. And here I'd like to raise also a word of praise for what happened at this conference, because we discovered an earnestness of all parties to be pastoral in what they meant with their missionizing or with their liturgical commitments. The dialogue can happen. We can sing the song together. The Spirit can move among us. And I think one of the issues that was raised for us this morning by Dean Hempelman was why that kind of fruitful interchange, as we have had between evangelism and worship, is not taking place also between worship and other areas of the congregation's life, such as pastoral care. We've had lots of discussions about the interrelationship of worship and church growth and so forth in the last few years. But we haven't started to discover yet how worship and pastoral, except for in a few publications like Wellman's and so forth, or in social ministry, and so forth. And some of this is happening here and there in a few corners of the church. I hope one of the visions I would hold for the 1990s, suggestion, John, is that we continue to have worship as the theme, but always as it is the foundation for the other work of the church, because that's where it begins, in the presence of God. That's where we might go. Then I'd like to move on and suggest a couple resources for our journey in the 1990s, and I'd like to address two issues. The first has to do with something that comes up time and time again, and it did here, in private conversations and elsewhere, and that is the issue of meaning and variety in worship. The second thing I'd like to offer you for your journey in the 1990s is Gebauer's Law of Liturgical Reality. Well, we'll deal with meaning and variety in worship first. Now, when we say that we're looking for meaningful worship, Or can't we have some variety? Or isn't variety something that is going to debilitate our tradition? This idea of meaning variety can mean one of two things, or several things. One of them is, it can mean we want a worship service that is more attractive, that does not offend those who visit us, and those exact words are used. I'd like to just mention one experience to this, and it's, again, a reductio ad absurdum, but it helps us realize what some of the issues are. And that is the experience of the Danish church. It was written up in the Arbo for Liturgia and Hymnology a few years ago. And the issue there was that the church authorities rose in conference and said, in fact, the bishop of the Danish church rose and said, I like the classical liturgy as much as anybody else, and then came the famous, but I want to be able to go to church with my grandchildren. And he recognized in his society what has been clearly pointed out in our own. There has been a paradigm shift in our society. You can't take it for granted that the younger generation is going to have the same allegiance to all these things. The answer to that was to set up a church-wide commission to redraft all the rights of the church so that they would be universally inviting to all those who might be out there in society, that the church would continue to function within the society in that way. The result of this, and I'll give you just two examples, was, first of all, a baptismal rite, in which it was understood that baptism is something which is done as a tradition in most Danish families, and if you then use in the rite the words that I baptize you into, the name of Jesus Christ, this could offend some of the relatives who don't consider themselves Christian. So baptismal rites were drawn without reference to Jesus Christ. The marriage services, recognizing modern realities, of course, simply would promise that people wanted to be faithful, not that they would be faithful, and so forth. The issue here is that is an example, as I mentioned before, of a politicization of the liturgy. The liturgy used for some kind of other political end. The result of this was that a free conference, an unofficial group, rose up, and these rites, by the way, were adopted officially by the Danish church, rose up and said, redrafted the rites more along the lines of the classic Lutheran tradition, and those eventually became a strong enough movement within the church to be restored, and so forth. That's one thing about attractiveness. There is an issue with that. The second thing is, as we heard, that the liturgy then becomes edifying or can make an impact. While there is a very important pastoral note of concern for the people in the pew that should not be ignored. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. The other side of that is that we need to remember that it is God who is the primary actor in the liturgy, and it is we who respond. There's, for example, a classic case of how we try to make the liturgy much more powerful in the lives of people. Toward the end of the 18th century, there's a church order from Schleswig-Holstein, which argued that there ought to be fewer Lord's Supper celebrations, because when it became so frequent, after all, you know, it was very important. It shouldn't just be left to chance. That much rather they should just not have any celebrations of the Lord's Supper, except for a couple big Eucharistic festivals, maybe in the spring of the year and the fall of the year, when you do it several days in a row and make a big splash out of it. They didn't use that term in the 18th century. But they did argue that then it would have greater impact on people. Now, the assumptions behind that are really strange in view of our Eucharistic theology. The interesting thing about that is that those of you who have a little bit as much gray hair as I have will remember that it was precisely that argument which is used in much of our own confirmation instruction in the Missouri Synod. Frequency of the Lord's Supper makes it less valuable. To this day, I will ask questions in my classes, how often do you celebrate the Lord's Supper? And in some cases, it's once or twice. Usually, it's every other Sunday at least. And why don't we have it every Sunday? And almost invariably, somebody will say, well, you know, if you do it so often, then it's less valuable. And it doesn't mean as much. As if we create the meaning in that gift of God, and that by manipulating the way in which the gift has come, that somehow we can make or break the significance of it. Now, there's a real sensitivity, however, behind all of this in terms of what is meaningful. You will run into the church and find people there who say, I got nothing out of the service. And there are a couple responses to that. The first is, if God comes to us in his word, whether you like the sermon or not, and says, here is forgiveness of sins. If Jesus Christ offers his body and his blood in order to give us life and offer us the gift of life before the throne in heaven and bind us to one another as the body of Christ and give us hope and all of that, and you say, I didn't get anything out of it, exactly what is it that you wanted? What greater gift was there that was missing? The second response to that is, on the part of those of us who are responsible to the church, if somebody says, I didn't get anything out of it, believe them. They didn't. What that means is that we have lost the battle to the culture around us, and it's a reality. Pastor Thompson is right. There is a different world out there, and all those who have studied this issue with him know that he is correct. Pastors may be powerful, but they cannot command people to believe and worship this way because they ought to. They just won't. Surveys do help, sorry. Surveys do help. Not to tell us how we should worship, but to discover the world in which we are ministering. The danger in this, however, is to assume then that if that isn't working, then something else will, and that is not true. It's dangerous to assume that if the liturgy of the church doesn't mean anything to somebody, that something else will. It is dangerous to assume that that variety will help out. That is contrary to all experience with humanity. Variety does not create meaning. Change does not. What we want is the familiar. Every study I know of, and I protect myself against being a survey addict, I'll use the word study. Every study that I know of says that what people respond to is what they are familiar with. It's not that we want something different. It's that what happens in church on Sunday morning is what is different that causes the problem. The real issue, therefore, is, and I think I'd like to suggest as my gift to the symposium, is that the issue is not what does it mean or how should we do it. The real issue is that people will respond to what is significant. Now, the issue is how do they decide what is the source of significance? I'm not suggesting this is Christian or unchristian. I'm just saying what happens. There are two elements that create significance. One is that an act happens within a community and receives its significance from that community, from the consensus of the community. Privatization is not working. And we all know that if you've read Bella, Habits of the Heart, and all the other literature like that. The second issue is that it requires memory. Significance, therefore, taking the first issue, has to do with community. We will find significance only in a continued activity that occurs within a community repetitively over a long period of time. And there is a general pattern of significance. The issue that we have to discover with people who are in the churches with us on Sunday morning is which community they identify with. And when you are bombarded by the 1,500 messages a day that we were instructed about yesterday, that the nature of that community is not to be taken for granted. That community will be defined by my race, by my class, by my socioeconomic circumstances. And I do have to ask the question, and that leads us to the question, of whether some of the tension that exists between church growth and liturgics, or what's considered classic liturgics, doesn't have to do more with the general division of forces in the American church life today than it does with those two particular issues. That there is a style of worship which seems to be more appropriate, and that style is identified with certain cultural trends in the United States. And it goes for both sides of the issue. Let me give you an example of how community creates that. What we mean is that when a community discovers significance, then the people who identify with that community discover the significance of themselves and their lives in terms that are part of the pattern of significance in the community. I'll tell you a story, which was, for me, the first time I heard it, a very touching story. And it occurred in the context of a meeting of the North American Academy of Liturgy. And we were addressed by a Jewish rabbi, energetic young fellow from Chicago, great scholar. And he pointed out that, like all energetic young guys, professionals, he worked too hard, so his family and his synagogue people told him he ought to take off and get a little rest. So he did. Took a ski trip out to Vermont. And he said it was a marvelous place. They had ski slopes, and they had resort people and all kinds of professionals, but he couldn't enjoy a minute of it. And the reason was that it was so carefully done. If you needed instruction, you were sent over here. If you needed equipment, you were sent to this place. When it was time to go up the mountain, they had the trucks ready for you to climb up. When you needed to be by yourself to discover how to manipulate the skis, they knew how to take care of your children and would take them away. But for those who had survived the Holocaust, every experience receives its significance from that moment. And what we do in living out our lives is to engage in one act after the other, which always is significant to the extent that identifies with the pattern of significance in the community. He could only think of all the other trucks that had carried people away, all the other lines in which children had been taken up, and he had to go home. He said, "There is no member of my synagogue who hasn't had that event touch them. Each moment of their lives is a ritual reliving of that significance, and that's why the Jewish community is so desperate not to forget." Now, that also explains the example we heard this morning from Dean Hempelman, Krista's experience. The moment in my life that has profound significance is now seen to be part of that ancient metaphor which is provided for us by the biblical experience, which is rehearsed for us liturgy after liturgy. This only takes place within community. It only occurs ritually as this is in a repetitious fashion. It only occurs where the experience itself, it has this, what was called at one point, apparent irrelevance, that it has no utilitarian value. It only occurs where there is a deep value that lies beyond literal expression. And it's at that point that I'm always a little puzzled by the nature of our discussions, because just in experience, two groups that have been able to help each other a great deal are missionaries and anthropologists, that they've interfaced with other cultures and so on. And as they have discovered many of these ritual patterns and have helped to open them up for us, and on the other hand, it is the ritualists and the liturgists, the students of ritual and liturgy, who have been struggling to help each other understand what is going on. There's a natural convergence of interests at that point, which makes me puzzled as to why our conversations so frequently go like that. And I would suggest there's no other way than experiencing things within the community like that for things to be significant. And they will. And the issue of whether it's repetitious or not makes no difference. There is nothing boring about repetition. If there were, we would hear objections time and again, my classic example of this, of why do we have to have that same old hymn at birthday parties? Happy birthday to you. We sang happy birthday to you last time. Nobody ever says that. It just doesn't get boring. Because that is the essence of a birthday party, is to sing happy birthday to you. If he hadn't been so embarrassed about it, we would have sang happy birthday to Horace Hummel on the quad last night, since that was his birthday. And we all knew what to do. And you can repeat that. Nobody ever says, a Christmas tree. We had a Christmas tree last year and the year before that. I mean, couldn't we do something different? We can't have a little variety in Christmas. It doesn't happen. The most significant moments of our lives are the most highly predictable and repetitious. I think we need to take that into account. Liturgy, then, is a constant use of old metaphors. For us, it's not the Holocaust. For us, it's the overwhelming impact of the fact that Jesus Christ suffered and died and rose from the dead out of love for his people. It is death and resurrection which is celebrated. It is the grace of God's creation. It's the prophetic thunder of law as it reaches out to give shape to the guilt that is still oozing out of our sin-dulled consciousness even after all these centuries and modern sophistication. It is the celebration of the Exodus. It is the celebration of the restoration of the kingdom and of Reformation and of the martyrdom of the saints. And it's there that I can understand what pain is, even if I experience it, and what redemption there is in pain. That's liturgy, and that creates significance. And it is at that point that we need to listen to those who say we have to understand the needs of our people. If we didn't understand the needs of our people, then Jesus would have had to have said to the woman who wanted to touch the hem of his garment, let's not be so self-centered about this. Another issue then has to do with symbolism. that those things which are significant are usually symbolic. And there's a longer discussion necessary, but I'd like to point out that there's a difference between symbols and signs. And we have often in our discussions taken what is symbolic and insisted that it have the clarity of a sign. Just briefly, a symbol is multivalent. It has deep power. It usually has a certain amount of ambiguity, so much so that the relationship between the symbol and the object of its reference is often not easy to distinguish. A sign is very clear. It means one thing. A sign can be created at will. If I create an octagon and tell you whenever you see that sign, you stop your car, or under some penalties, we know exactly what that means. A symbol only achieves its power in a longer process. And what I've heard sometimes is that we take something symbolic and say, what does it mean? If it means that, then it cannot mean anything else. And we have closed the argument to one another. When our symbols and our liturgies lose power, they are characteristic of what Adolf Jensen some years ago wrote on a ritual and so forth called the process of semantic depletion. When a rite or a religion even is in what he calls a state of expression, it is done because it means something. When you're not sure about it, or you control the judgments about whether it means something, then it is in a state of expression, a state of application. And then you do it so that it means something, not because it means something. In its worst forms, that descends into magic. And I think some of that has happened among us, where you say, I'm going to use something so that it happens. Another way in discovering meaning is that how meaning occurs is to describe it in terms of what's been called by some scholars vernacular experience as opposed to cultivated experience. These were categories that were developed by a scholar in Kolenhoven a few years ago, and they become something that's become a seminal concept in American studies, and above all, in writing American music history and church music history. A vernacular experience, according to this thinking, it's been further articulated by a scholar named Richard Crawford, always has to do with memory. Something that is significant always derives from prior memory, and that's what I was talking about before. The style of music is not the issue. The issue is whether the person already knows it and has that familiarity and then can sing it easily. Some of the most gosh-awful melodies are people's old favorite. I personally do not like Lost in Zerfreuen. If you sing our versions of Lost in Zerfreuen, you know, la 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 la, you get to sing a descending tetrachord 49 times by the end of that melody. I mean, that's too much. It's not a good melodic curve either. But people love that hymn. It soars way out of range. It's awful. But we love it. We love to go screaming out that hymn. That's an example of vernacular experience. A vernacular always depends on prior experience. Vernacular experience has an authenticity that consumes me, that I take for granted, and that is involuntary. Above all, it's involuntary. And I think we need to understand that context when people talk about user-friendly liturgies. The issue is not whether the liturgy is user-friendly. It may or may not be. The issue is whether it's faithful to word and sacrament. User-friendly is not a positive or negative term. It's simply a strategic way of going about this. When we become highly reflective, we lose our sense of vernacularity. That's why it was pointed out, Studs Terkel, as he did some of his oral histories, would never interview people who had advanced degrees. Couldn't trust what they'd say anymore. But it has been also argued by in this line of thinking, the alternative to that is a cultivated experience. And there are people, by reason of education, I count myself as one of them, whose experiences become more and more calculated. They are chosen. They are not involuntary. To a certain extent, they work against the grain of my prior experience. But cultivated experiences for some persons, in the long haul, are repeated so often and in so many significant contexts that that those new experiences become vernacular. That is, to this day, why I choke up when I hear a Bach cantata. Happened to me just last week. Played a Bach cantata on a drop-the-needle quiz for my music history class, and I literally had to turn away. It was just too much. And I had to cultivate, the experience was largely cultivated for me, but I chose it after a while. Somebody else listening to Bach cantata, even in my class, would say, gag me to the max, you know. So memory is always there. I offer you as an alternative to the debates about what liturgy can or cannot mean and ask you to consider what is significant. Not what is semantically depleted. It is in our culture. But it is the job of the church and the function of our catechesis to cultivate that experience over and over again. And here we might want to discuss somewhere along the line the grand Lutheran tradition of contrafaction that all church musicians know about, whereby you take an object of experience out of its original context, which is the old sinful world. And by that kind of cultivation, restore it to its proper function in the created order before the fall, namely the praise of God. We do that with music, and that's a model for all experience. That is also, we can see that in terms just of the ritual process. Irving Goffman and some of the other sociologists of religion can point that out. It's that process of cultivation which can provide a model for this. There are three stages always in basic. There's the stage of separation, then that area called liminality, where we are in an unstructured situation. We can't identify back here, and we still don't identify with the new. That's the role or the state of the catechumen. That's a painful stage. It's a growth stage. It's the place where people coming to Jesus who don't understand their new existence yet need to be surrounded by the love of those whom, in this latter day at least, we call their sponsors. That's what happened in the old Lenten series, where you went through exorcisms time and time again, standing on the goat skin, which was the world, and as the bishop would come and exorcise Satan time and again, until, in a sense, we gradually won more territory in that person's life, until they could be presented for new roles and the washing of renewal in the Easter Vigil. Now, in a couple minutes here, I'll give you Gebauer's Law of Liturgical Reality. Where are we going in the 70s, 80s, and 90s? If we tried to learn how to worship again, worship renewal in the 1970s, and we tried to learn how to evangelize in the 1980s, in the 90s, we've discovered we need to do both. Gebauer's Law of Liturgical Reality, which I repeat at the drop of any hat in any class, is the problem in the church ain't the liturgy. By the way, I learned this law here in St. Louis. I grew up across the river in Granite City, and then I went to the seminary here and discovered what purgatory meant. And in St. Louis, you know, they talk about the weather as much as in Minnesota, but for different reasons. It ain't the heat, it's the humidity, right? It ain't the liturgy, it's the way we do it. My own thesis is that our worship, with some exceptions, is in as much need of renewal as our commitment to evangelism in the church. Those who say the liturgy is the barrier to evangelism just have it wrong. Sorry, folks. It's not those materials. It's the way we do them. One example. Go to some mountaintop experience that we've all had. District convention, synodical convention, youth gathering. Look at this face. Am I laughing? People will come home from those and they'll just feel as if they've been uplifted beyond their wildest expectation. The hymn singing, the worship services. Then they get back home and they do the same liturgy out of the same book, the same hymns that they sang back there, and they say, gee, it's boring to go to church on Sunday morning. It's not the materials, it's the way it's done. Example, and this is my litany of woe about the church's worship. If I guest preach around the upper Midwest up there, and once or twice a year, no hyperbole, discover a musician who could just read the notes on the page in the rhythms that are there, we're lucky. I laugh with you, but it's not funny. It ain't the liturgy, it's the way we do it. If we say we are proclaiming the Word of God, and then we have lectures who say the gospel for today is John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And you all know that I am not exaggerating. That is the way the gospel is read. We don't do the most minimal training of people to proclaim the word in that circumstance, And then we wonder why people can't remember what the lessons were later on or what their significance was, or that the visitor couldn't understand what the heck was going on here. I've calculated that an average pastor selects 8,000 to 10,000 hymns during the course of a 40-year career between age 25 and 65 without ever having taken a course in hymnody. That is raw irresponsibility. I'm sorry, but it is. And we could go on from there. I know pastors who are afraid to formulate prayers because they've been told they might be violating a rubric and do not have that faith in God as their Father to approach God as their Father, as their loving parent, because they've been told that that's wrong. Where are we going in the 1990s? In the 1990s, we're going to rediscover the rhythm of liturgy, shaped as that liturgy shapes the dynamics of life into the song of redemption. We're going to come into the presence of God so strongly as it is celebrated in word and sacrament that it becomes natural for all of us to say amen to one another against all the habits of social intercourse we learn in the shopping malls. The visitor who watches us walk into the presence of God and receive the gifts that God is saying will hear that amen on the part of the congregation and ask, what is this, this power that draws me? As the Ethiopian was drawn to ask the question, as the disciples in Emmaus knew that something was there, and it had and wanted to have it revealed to them. In the 1990s, we're going to turn toward that omega point where Jesus Christ comes to our lives again and again and again. We'll move toward the year 2000 with the power of God surging so powerfully through our worship that it will result in the mission of the church as naturally as it results in potlucks. Evangelists, all of us, will descend from the mountain like Moses, where we have been in the presence of God in word and sacrament. And in that presence, it becomes so radiant that the world will feel some hope against the sense of its own guilt, its own sin, as it watches scab-burned Kurdish children, as it watches divorce rates rise, as you read every week in the family section of the newspapers how men and women can't get along with each other, how we discover the pain of isolated lives where our economy drives us into more individualized existences. But that radiance will shine through us in the 1990s to the glory of God. Thank you. We deliberately tried to keep a few minutes here so that we would have time for some response. Maybe if you'd like to ask questions about anything that's occurred in this symposium, I'll try to field them as best I can at no extra charge.
Dr. Roth, the question I have, in a sense, was brought up by Dean Hentelman, but it's one that I haven't heard enough about. I think, how does the cross fit in? And the way I would put it in a sense of the expectations for happiness in worship, to relate that to the cross. In other words, have we any right to expect to be made happy in the worship? Or is there even a distinction between happy and joyful?
Well, we're obviously dealing with a lot of semantics at this point, and I think what I was trying to indicate, at least I'll just refer to one aspect of what I was talking about, is that, yes, we certainly can expect the cross, experience the cross, and it is, in fact, both to the cross and to the tomb that we are called if we are baptized into Jesus Christ. Romans 6 is very clear about that, And Luther was in this baptismal schema. That is, that we are drowned, we die to the old life, and rise again. That language is not accidental. It means that we are called to give up whatever our former blankets of security were, and whatever our former systems of hope were, because they are, in effect, moribund in the old world. And in that sense, there's the cross is inevitable. They may come in other more specific ways. But to me, that seems fairly obvious. I'm a little bit struggling to understand the significance of the question. If you possibly have reference to the fact that some people regard all of liturgy as, for instance, consisting of praise hymns, so you mentioned that, or talked about that aspect in your thing yesterday. I think a couple of things. At its surface level, no, that's just too superficial. The other side of that is that if I think our responsibility is to be faithful in our, in celebrating Word and Sacrament, I take it as an article of faith that it is God's promise to fill us with joy. That the joy is defined in the presence of God. I have a sense that behind the question was, whose joy is it? Not whether there is joy or not. That one of the things you learn in a new existence, in a baptized existence, is all the ways that God can give you joy that you hadn't known before. But it requires giving up something, and that sometimes can be a painful cross. At least schematically, I would have to answer in that way. Yes, there is a cross. You may take it for granted that God wants life, peace, and joy for his people. Dave Andrews.
I've enjoyed your words, especially the last little bit that you said of it's not what we do, but the way we do it. And as I was listening to you talk throughout the last hour, it all of a sudden occurred to me, I wonder if you had the wrong title given to you, where we are going in the 90s. As confessional Lutherans, wouldn't we say we're going nowhere? But the world is going away, and we continue to stay with God, with the Word and sacraments. Instead of where are we going, we should look at how we're being pulled away from God rather than where we are going to, tying in again with your last words of the way we do it.
You've schematized it slightly differently, but and I wouldn't quarrel with you at all. I can mention one thing, though. In this issue of the issue of significant experience occurring within a community, when Professor Thompson pointed out yesterday that there are like 1,500 messages a day bombarding your soul, that creates community. I think one of the things that we have discovered is that we have not understood that very clearly, and we have not discovered the power that we have in our own theological resources to address that issue. And that's a problem. It's a serious problem. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with the theological issues, that the world is going to set our agenda. It simply means that we need to rediscover how to use them in that particular situation and how to let God carry that work forward. Thank you, David. There being no further discussion, I think we're ready for the itinerarium.